You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, I'm very pleased to be talking to T.J. Klune. He is a fantasy, sci-fi, romantic fiction, Lamba Literary Award, and New York Times best-selling author. And today, we're going to be talking to him about the Port Townsend 2022 Community Read, The House in the Cerulean Sea. Don't you want to be there, folks? I do. Hi, T.J. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a joyful fantasy, and everybody's going to love to read it during the Community Read Month and beyond. And I read a little blurb that said, "You'll only be threatened a little bit by a gnome with a shovel and the Antichrist."
Exactly right.
There's some humor in this story. And I'd like you to just really start off by setting the stage for us by doing a short reading. Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely. So The House in the Cerulean Sea is about a man named Linus Baker, who is a caseworker for the department in charge of magical youth. In this world, magical people are feared, and they try to keep them separate from what they consider normal humans. And in this case, it's Linus's job to inspect orphanages that cater to magical children. And he is being given a classified assignment by his superiors to go to a very particular orphanage where there are supposedly six dangerous magical children with enough power to destroy the world. And it's his job to see if that's true or if there's a whole lot of nothing there. So in this scene that I'll do a reading from, he's just arrived at the island for the first time, and he has brought his cat with him who has escaped from the car, so he's gone to chase after her. There was an apple tree growing near the house, and Linus blinked when he saw red and green and pinkish apples, all different varieties growing on the same limbs. He followed the trunk down toward the ground and saw a little statue, a garden gnome. "How quaint," he murmured as he moved around the tree. The statue was bigger than the ones he had seen before, the tip of its pointed cap about waist high. It had a white beard, and its hands were clasped at its front. The paint job that had been done on the statue was remarkably detailed, almost lifelike in the fading light. The eyes were a bright blue, and its cheeks were rosy. "Strange statue, aren't you?" he said, hunkering down in front of it. Had Linus been in his right mind, he would have noticed the eyes. However, he was tired, out of sorts, and worried about his cat. Therefore, the noise that came out of him wasn't that surprising when the gnome statue blinked and said rather haughtily, "You can't just say something like that about a person. It's rude. Don't you know anything?" His scream was strangled as he fell backward, hands digging into the grass beneath him. The gnome sniffed. "You're awfully loud. I don't like it when people are loud in my garden. If you're loud, you can't hear all the flowers talking." And she, because she was a she, beard and all, reached up and straightened her cap. "Gardens are quiet spaces." Linus struggled to find his voice. You, she frowned. "Of course I'm me. Who else would I be?" He shook his head, managing to clear the cobwebs before latching onto a name. "You're a gnome." She blinked owlishly at him. "Yes, I am. I'm Talia." She bent over and picked up a small shovel that had been laying on the grass next to her. "Are you Mr. Baker? If you are, we've been expecting you. If not, you're trespassing. You should leave before I bury you here in my garden. No one would ever know because the roots would eat your entrails and your bones." She frowned again. "I think. I've never buried anyone before. It could be a learning experience for the both of us." "I'm Mr. Baker." Talia sighed, sounding incredibly disappointed. "Of course you are. No need to shout about it. But is it too much to ask for a trespasser? I've always wanted to see if humans make good fertilizer. Seems like they would." She eyed him up and down hungrily. "All that flesh." "Oh dear," Linus managed to say. There you go.
So you can see, dear listeners, that there's a little bit of humor here, but there's a little bit of like, well, really, what's going to happen? There's a little bit of fear. And, you know, I think of the theme, the fear of the unknown. That's kind of big in this. But we'll talk about that later. Tell us some more about Linus. He's such a fascinating character.
He is. He is a man in his 40s. He's a bit fussy, a bit stuck in his routine. He's overweight. He lives alone with his cat in his little house, and he is stuck in a rut. He has a job that he's been at for 14 years. He lives in a city where there is no color and the rain never ends. And he is, I don't know if I could say happy and maybe not even content, but he has been in this rut for so long that it's become his normal. And the only bit of color that he has in his entire life are a few sunflowers that he's planted in the front of his house. And you can tell even from these early pages before he gets to the island that Linus is someone who, while stuck in a rut, is someone who cares about what he does. His job is to basically check on children to make sure that they are not being harmed, that they're being cared for as best as he can, as best as these orphanages can. And that's not always the case. And it's his job to determine whether the children are safe or not. And so through his journey, you see him begin to grow, to begin to open up, in a way, begin to flower. Mm-hmm. Because all he needed was basically a little sunlight and a little water and attention to show that there's something more beneath the surface.
Right. And, you know, it seems like he's really alone and the people around him are kind of mean. But, you know, the first indication about him is his neighbor says, oh, you know, I want to fix you up with, is it my son or my
grandson,
nephew,
yeah.
Something.
Nephew, something
and
like that,
and then you kind of go, Oh, Linus is gay or Linus is queer.
Right.
And so this is not a big deal in this book, but it's just part of the story. And he's just the main character, and he's a very positive character. So was this all intentional for you?
It was. I knew going into this story that I wanted to write about a man in his 40s, because typically heroes of fantasy, heroes of romance, heroes of most genres are not overweight, fussy men in their 40s who have thinning hair and basically work as a cog in a bureaucratic machine. I wanted to be able to have him be the hero because I think it goes to show that anybody can be a hero. Especially when they least expect it. And Linus, to me, is a hero, and his journey shows is a hero's journey, even though it might not mirror what we typically think of a hero's journey in fantasy. And the queer aspect of it, look, I try to keep my talking, or when I speak about books, apolitical, because, mm-hmm. you know, some readers don't like to talk about politics. But at the same time, being a queer person in the 21st century like I am, my entire life is political. People debate whether or not I have the right to have the same rights as everybody else. And with this, I didn't want this to be a big coming out book. Not that there's anything wrong with that trope, and there have been some extraordinarily wonderful young adult novels that handle the coming out process with care. But the thing is that I think that some people forget is that coming out isn't just a one-time deal for queer people. Anytime we meet someone new, we have to come out. That's someone that we could potentially have to come out to. It's a lifelong process.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, I didn't want to focus on that aspect of it. I just wanted to present this man, and being gay is part of him. It's not his entire identity, but it is part of him. And I really like that idea of people being allowed to just be queer without making a big deal about it in their book, as a character in a book. There doesn't need to be this whole big thing of, oh my gosh, I might be gay. It can be, you know what, I'm gay, let's move on.
That's right. That's right. And this is a very strong character-driven book. So not only is there Linus, but there's the children. And, you know, the one that's like really standing out is like the Antichrist. And mm-hmm. his name is Lucy. Can you talk a little bit about Lucy?
Yeah, Lucy. I knew going into when I was writing this book that Lucy was probably going to be the favorite amongst many of the readers, and that has proven true. But Lucy is a bit of an extreme. While the other children are also magical with different types of abilities or appearances that match their abilities, Lucy is an extreme. He is the quote-unquote Antichrist. And the reason that I wanted to go that direction, the reason that I wanted to include an Antichrist as a character, is the idea of nature versus nurture. we have this, we know, you know, even if you're not religious, you know of the idea of the Antichrist, this dark force that's supposed to rise and destroy humanity. And I kept thinking, what if that person, this person who is prophesized as to be the destroyer of humanity, what if they were a six-year-old boy? What would that look like? And what would it look like if that same six-year-old boy, instead of being taught to be evil, to grow into this devious, terrifying thing, that he was taught that it's okay to be good, that he doesn't have to be bad just because of his birthright or what people think of him? And so I wanted to run with the idea of nature versus nurture to show that you are not defined by your bloodline. Mm-hmm. You are defined by the actions that you take.
Mm-hmm. And there's some wonderful scenes where this kind of teaching or just interaction with Lucy goes on with the other characters and the master at the orphanage. And, you know, they're very sweet. It makes me think that you at one time were in a classroom because some of the parts of the book are kind of the ideal, wonderful curriculum for children out in the world. I just wanted to say that is great.
Yeah, it's to me the point of this, the book, and something that I strove really hard to get right, is that I didn't want these children to necessarily be precocious. I think that's a big kind of a fault that we could sometimes see in fiction and media, is that these children, young children, are wise beyond their years, and they're saying these huge, whole, big sentences with 15-syllable words that they probably have no idea what they actually mean. So with these kids, while they are these big, scary, supposedly scary, you know, figures and that have magical abilities, they're still kids.
That's
and
right.
And they still act like kids.
Yeah, they do.
They still have crazy, because what I love about kids is that they have not yet grown into a filter. They don't have a filter. They say whatever is on the top of their heads, and it can be the weirdest thing you've ever heard. But at the same time, there's something sad about growing old and actually getting that filter that most of us seem to get, because I think that we lose a little bit of that spark of youth mm-hmm. when that happens, mm-hmm. because we're so worried about what other people will think when we speak that we don't say always what's in our head and hearts. But when you're a kid like these kids, they'll say whatever comes into their head, whether it be a threat or a compliment.
Right. As a reader, you're not quite sure. You know, like there's a little bit of fear built into some of these mm-hmm. characters because we don't know them yet. But as we go through the book, we start to understand more about them, and the fear just melts away. So that, I think that fear of the unknown is a really cool theme in this book. And by the way, what's a wyvern? I think, you know, some of our listeners might want to know, because that was a new magical character to me.
Okay, yeah. A wyvern is a mythical creature that is basically a dragon, except the big difference between wyverns and dragons is that dragons are typically seen with four legs, whereas wyverns have two. And instead of having two front legs, that's where their wings are attached. So that is what Theodore is. I'd already written another fantasy series that dealt with dragons, but I wanted to have a different sort of creature in this house as a child, and one who couldn't speak English or the language that is in this book. This character, mm-hmm. Theodore, is not verbal like the other children are. However, he does speak in his own language. He speaks through chirps and grunts and clicks and growls, and the children and the Arthur, the master of this orphanage, all know what he's saying and mm-hmm. who he is. It's called receptive bilingualism, meaning that a person can speak one language fluently and understand another, but they may not be able to speak that other language themselves.
And Linus,
so I wanted to ask that.
Yeah, Linus begins to learn to understand Theodore too.
Correctly.
I love
exactly,
I
because he
Theodore.
Wants to. He wants to. It shows. I think that goes a big part in showing how much he cares about these kids.
Mm-hmm.
That he's actually beginning to learn that he's taking the time to do something that probably most adults would not do.
Yes, we're listening to T.J. Klune, and he's talking about his book, The House in the Cerulean Sea. And this is Book Lovers Cafe at KPTZ 91.9 FM. We are recording this, and it'll be on the podcast page. If you're just joining us and you want to hear the beginning or, you know, catch up with some of the other Book Lovers Cafe podcasts. So T.J. wrote not only The House in the Cerulean Sea, but Under the Whispering Door and The Extraordinaries, a YA series about a group of kids with superpowers. And he's written 25 books. He's been around for a while. But I'll tell you, these last two books have really caught on, and for good reason. They're lots of fun, and they're perfect for, they're perfect for all ages, I think. What was your intended audience for this book?
You know, I had never written a book with a younger audience in mind before. Most of my previous books are adult subject matter. They have adult language, adult content. And so when I was writing this, I wasn't necessarily thinking about a younger audience, and I was writing it as I normally did. But then I remember when my editor came to me when we first started editing the book, and she said, look, you have a couple of curse words in here. If you remove those, it could open a much bigger audience, because parents and guardians will go to a bookstore, they'll go to a library, and they'll ask the bookseller or librarian, is there any objectionable language in this, or is there any foul language that I don't want my kid to read? And a librarian or bookseller will say yes, or they'll say no, and that could potentially have a parent not want their kid to see that. So when I was thinking about that, when my editor came to me with that, I thought, okay, is that something that I want to do? Am I taking away from what I did initially? But then I realized, you know what? It's just a few words that don't add anything to the story. So why can't they be removed?
And they can.
They were. And I will tell you that I still, even after this book came out, I never really considered myself a children's author until I got an email from a father and his son, his 9-year-old son, and the father started the message with, what follows is a direct message from my son. He asked that I type exactly what he says. So what after that was a huge block of stream of consciousness talking that this 9-year-old boy, he was talking about how he loved to read the book and how it didn't make him feel so lonely because the pandemic wasn't letting him see his friends.
Yeah.
And he was very sad about that. And that when he read this book, it felt like he had his friends around him. And would I like to see his Chauncey costume?
Oh, my goodness.
And so I said,
let's talk about Chauncey for a minute.
I want to see the Chauncey costume. Yeah.
So Chauncey is, you know, unidentifiable as anything but a monster. And once again, you kind of let people know that no matter what you are or what people say about you, you can, you know, be who you want to be and discover yourself. So there's a lot for young adults and for adults to share with children. And it can be really for anybody. I found it very enjoyable. And, you know, I'm a grandma, so there you go.
I want it to be a book for anyone because I think that these types of stories are missing. These days, you know, fantasy is usually full of swords and grim, dark, evil things happening. When I was a kid, my favorite book was Diana Wynne Jones' Howl's Moving Castle. Cozy fantasy. And I love the idea of cozy fantasies where maybe there aren't huge action set pieces that go on, but at the same time, it feels like you do when you wear that comfortable sweater, the one with holes in the sleeves for your thumb. That's what I wanted to have this book feel like.
That's great. And it was written, you finished it in 2018, so it kind of, it was kind of written before, but then it became the perfect book. I also want to say, there's this deal where, you know, it's raining and it's dark, and you come into this colorful world. And I went, oh my goodness, you know, there we are. It's the Wizard of Oz sort of
thing. That was my allusion to that. I took what I remember being a kid and seeing Wizard of Oz in theaters for the first time, and that pop from the sepia tone Kansas to the Technicolor Oz was just something that I don't know if I've still recovered from that. It was just one of the most gorgeous things that I've ever seen. So I wanted to pay homage to that in this book, where Linus gets to go see a world full of color at the island for the first time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your own writing journey. I mean, you know, some people I've talked to and they go, well, you know, I got my MFA and I was influenced by all of this, but you took a different path. So tell us about how you became a writer.
Yeah, so I do not have an MFA. I have 1 year of community college under my belt, and that's as far as I go with that. But I when I was a kid, 6, 7 years old, I would always carry a notebook around with me that I would just fill with stories of whatever entered my head. Did they make sense? Probably not. Were they any good? No, they were not. I actually found one of my old notebooks a couple of years ago and cringed my way through my old stories. But I learned from two very specific people, Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer, my seventh grade English teachers, that words have power, and they have the power to bring people happiness. They have the power to bring people joy. They taught me to use my words and they encouraged me, telling me that one day they would see a book with my name on it at a bookstore. And they were the people who believed in me more than above any others. And without them, I would not be here today.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2010, I said, you know, as one does, why don't I write a book and see what happens? So I did that, wrote a book, Googled independent publishers because I didn't have an agent or anything like that. I didn't even know how to go about getting an agent. And I Googled independent publishers, particularly those that dealt with queer fiction. Found a few, set the manuscript off, and the rest, as they say, I guess, is history. The book was picked up and did better than anyone thought it would. And here I am 11 years later, a full-time writer and having published over 20 books.
That's great. But you make it sound easy, TJ.
Yeah.
And it, and you know, but
me,
let's talk about the work and the planning and, you know, how you actually make one of these books come to fruition.
Exactly.
How does it start with you?
Types of books, it usually starts with a voice, a character. For me, in this case, I heard Lucy talking in my head. And sometimes when that happens, the voice will peter out on its own and it won't amount to anything. But I'll know something is there when the characters start talking louder and louder and louder. And Lucy was practically screaming by the time I sat down to write. And I knew I had been wrestling with the idea of writing magical something for a while, and I knew I wanted it to be about kids and the idea of fear of the unknown and how that plays into how it affects bigotry and what we look at through government bureaucracy and how that affects the people that are marginalized. And I didn't quite know how to make it all put together, because I thought I was going to start and stay on the island and just have it be about the people on the island. But then I stepped back and said, what would it look like for an outsider coming into this place?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Linus came into the picture.
Right.
And then I built basically the book around him, because the idea of having a man in his 40s be the hero of a fantasy novel is just something you don't see. And as queer man at that, a queer man who has some extra pounds, a queer man with thinning hair, a queer man who lives alone with his cat. We don't get to see those people be the heroes.
No.
And so when I figured out that Linus was going to be the one to tell the story, it just all fell into place.
Oh, that's great. And I wanted to make sure that I brought up the fact about Lucy being a collector of records, and there's a scene in a record store, and music is important in this book as well. It's important to us at KPTZ, that's for sure. So what kind of music, how did you choose the music, and why did you like have this musical part of the book?
So music is a big part of my writing experience. When I begin a book, I will start compiling playlists of music that I think fits within the book. And typically, we'll take House in the Cerulean Sea, for example. By the time I'd finished, the playlist for the House in the Cerulean Sea was almost 500 songs long. And I listen to that on rotation. I listen to that when I'm walking my dog. I listen to that when I'm at the grocery store, just so it keeps me in the story. But the reason music played such a big part in this book was because the idea of these records, there's a timeless quality about this story. There's no specific year that's mentioned that it's set in. It could be the past, it could be the present, it could be the future. There's computers, but no cell phones are mentioned, no televisions. But music, specifically records, play a huge part in this. And the reason being, A, for my love of music, but B, I grew up listening to vinyl. I grew up listening to records. I grew up listening to the Big Bopper, Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, all of these amazing artists from the 40s and the 50s who, by the time I was born or by the time I started to appreciate the music, were gone. It's as Lucy says in the book, it's a dead people music. And there's such an eerie quality that you can get by listening to records that you can't get hearing from streaming or compact disc. There's just something so wonderful about the sound that comes from a record that I just wanted to include that in this book and make it about all of my favorite music from that time period.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, when you mention the songs and you mention the records, that means the reader is thinking of those songs as well.
And I've heard from so many yes. readers who put when these songs came up in the book, they added that song to a playlist and started listening to these songs as they read the book.
Right.
And that is a wonderful thing to do.
Well, these songs are already in my head, so I didn't have to put them on a playlist. but yes, so I did want to say I started to kind of think about them and hum them and singing. And that's really a great aspect of this story. So there are the themes of prejudice, and there's, you know, I want to talk about, or just mention, because we have to, the extremely upper management. I mean, that is such a great moniker of who's in control here, extremely upper management. And so that's part of the wonderful humor of this book. How did you think of that?
Well, I think that if you've worked in the corporate world for any length of time, I think that we could all recognize somebody who could be described as working for extremely upper management. It's a very officious, it's a very significant sounding title. And I actually worked in the corporate world before I became a full-time writer, sitting in my soul-sucking cubicle
while I was
answering the phones on end, and I know how that feels.
Okay, so we're not drowning in the bureaucracy anymore. Here's to the arts, and here's to T.J. Clune and the House in the Cerulean Sea. You have been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. And we reviewed The House in the Cerulean Sea, The Whispering Door, and The Extraordinaries. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kptz.org. You could also make a donation to the station as well. Thank you to the engineer, Taylor Clark, and our editor. And also, wait a minute, we got to thank the volunteers and the supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. We'll see you next time.
While walking through the woods and not far from town, I got real shook, I heard the strangest sound. I saw the purple people eater, and to my surprise, the witch doctor sitting by his side. The witch doctor had a little guitar in his hand, and they were popping and a rocking with a two-piece band. Purple was a-blowing like a...